Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for discussing Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm host John McCoy, and with me is first-time host Laura Hayes.
Hi, glad to be here.
Hi, Laura. Now Laura is, as we say in the business, a friend from the pre-web days. We actually met back when I was in grad school and you were in college.
Yeah, about 1989 or 1990.
1990. We worked together in a library. And we could tell stories, but we won't. But I've known Laura now for, oh God, 30 years.
It's a long, long time.
Now, you want to tell people a little bit about yourself?
Roundaboutly, after leaving the rich environment of the university library, I did various jobs like a programmer and ended up going to law school and becoming an attorney and really boring material. But I have a strange hobby. Somewhere along the line, I picked up a very active dog and tried to find a way to tire the dog out, and that was mushing. Now I have 6 dogs and moved to New Hampshire and own a dog sled. And my husband and I he's a very competitive musher when it comes to skiing and biking with the dogs, and I sometimes drive a 4-dog team. So... it's actually a big thing in New England, and people think of dog mushing as the Iditarod, but that didn't get started until like the 70s. And what really the sport came from was sprint racing in New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and then like the Iditarod kind of took preeminence, and that's what people associate with the sport now.
Did this inform your choice of the book that we read this time?
I thought it would be interesting to go back and look at the book because in the 1980s, some old-time dog drivers got together and were hanging out in a bar in Dawson City, I believe. And we're like, this Iditarod race, this is kind of soft. Let's recreate the Yukon Rush Trail and have a race there. And so having heard people talk about running that race, I kind of wanted to go back and say, so how accurately does he represent how it's like to actually be out with dogs in that kind of terrain? So it did kind of inform my opinion of the book and kind of desire to read it now that I had some understanding of what being on a trail with dogs is like. You will not get a great education about that from this book.
Now, is there a dog in the background right now? Because I'm hearing some thumping.
Yes, someone is going outside.
Okay, so this time we are doing Jack London's 1903 novel Call of the Wild. Which is a book that I've been asked to do on this podcast many, many times. It was on a lot of middle school and high school reading lists. Now I'm going to shock everyone and say I had not read this book before reading it for the podcast. So I have no history with this book. What history do you have with this book?
I think I read it when I was in middle school because I was... a nerdy child that just liked to read anything and everything, and I liked animals a whole lot, so I'm like, yeah, read this and White Fang, just kind of the opposite story of this book.
Call of the Wild is Jack London's novel of a domesticated dog named Buck who is stolen and sold into the life of a sled dog, goes through many owners, most bad, some good, and ends up eventually succumbing to the titular Call of the Wild by joining a wolf pack at the end of the book. And this was the book that made Jack London his fortune. I mean, he strikes me as being prototypical of the early modernist ideal of the vigorous male writer. He worked his way up from rags to riches. He actually spent some time in the Yukon And he did a little bit of everything as a child, from being a farmhand to being a newsboy to apparently being an oyster pirate, which I imagine means you poach oysters where you're not supposed to. And he lived a hard, fast, hard drinking life and wrote about manly, vigorous subjects and died young. So you can see how he sort of paved the way for Ernest Hemingway and William Faulkner and that sort of thing.
A little bit about George Orwell too, because he was a war correspondent. And one of the fascinating tidbits I discovered about him is that he wrote this dystopian novel about how the upper like 0.05% of the wealthiest people in America ran a totalitarian oligarchy. It was called the Iron Heel, and how it took normal Americans 300 years to overthrow their yoke. So he had a little hand in, dystopian science fiction as well as naturalistic stories of man returning to a primitive, improved moral state. So quite a range of material he covered.
He was a socialist, like a fairly strong socialist for most of his life, and that comes out in some ways in this book. Although this book is mostly a sort of a mishmash of Darwinism and also ruminations on the power of the frontier. It's interesting to see that this book came out just a few years after Rudyard Kipling's The Jungle Book, which was enormously popular throughout the English-speaking world, and featured again animals whose thoughts we are privy to. And it's interesting to put this to locate that in that history of how you write about animals from a phenomenological experience. He tries, I think, in this book to present Buck in what we're supposed to think of as a realistic fashion, that we're supposed to take this psychology of the dog seriously. What did you think about that?
There were parts that seemed kind of accurate to what we know of psychology of dogs now, but definitely was very much, I think, written from the perspective of a man and not a dog. Because a certain like a moral awareness or maybe projection of too little of a moral awareness, it's kind of difficult to place it because we only know so much about how dogs have, what kind of moral life a dog might have. They do seem to understand fairness. So definitely how Buck reacts to different owners being more brutal or making bad decisions, and how hard the dogs are willing to work for such owners, that really rings true, that they have really good understanding of fairness. And yeah, I'm kind of like drifting away from my point here, because I was thinking about how apparently there was this whole controversy at the time The Call of the Wild came out, and I think you also had Black Beauty, about the fake nature controversy, where people were saying, oh, you can't ascribe so many moral motivations to animals or such complicated thought processes to animals. It's just as presenting nature and animals as complete quackery, and you have to treat them more as automatons going on instinct. So there was kind of like a real pushback to books like Black Beauty and Call of the Wild and this anthropomorphization. People are looking for a more, perhaps more Darwinistic or science-informed presentation of animals. That was interesting that that caused like a whole literary kerfluffle.
There is this way in which we want to ascribe human motivation to animals' actions, and particularly in this book, the thing that I found strange was the way that Buck was able to constantly abstract from the current situation into larger sets of values that the dog was developing. Or in the novel, London is. Equates this with an instinctual transmission of codes of ethics or ways of being that are passed through bloodlines. Early on in the book, there's a section where once Buck, who lived a kind of a life of leisure in this rich middle-class house in California, when he first is brought up into the world of being a sled dog, after enduring a kind of a brutal training by this guy who's only called, what, like the man in the red shirt or something like that.
Yeah, that's what I...
Who beats him and breaks him. Once he's actually out and about and working for these two French Canadian dispatchers, he starts to enjoy it. And there's a passage that I think illustrates London's project.
All that stirring of old instincts, which at stated periods drives men out from the sounding cities to forest and plain to kill things, by chemically propelled leaden pellets, the bloodlust, the joy to kill. All this was Buck's, only it was infinitely more intimate. He was ranging at the head of the pack, running the wild thing down, the living meat, to kill with his own teeth and wash his muzzle to the eyes in warm blood. There's an ecstasy that marks the summit of life, and beyond which life cannot rise. And such is the paradox of living. This ecstasy comes when one is most alive, and it comes as a complete forgetfulness that one is alive. This ecstasy, this forgetfulness of living, comes to the artist, caught up and out of himself in a sheet of flame. It comes to the soldier, war mad on a stricken field and refusing quarter, and it came to Buck, leading the pack, sounding the old wolf cry, straining after the food that was alive and that fled swiftly before him through the moonlight. He was sounding the deeps of his nature, and the parts of his nature that were deeper than he, going back into the womb of time. He was mastered by the sheer surging of life, the tidal wave of being. The perfect joy of each separate muscle, joint, and sinew, in that it was everything that was not death, that it was aglow and rampant, expressing itself in movement, flying exultantly under the stars and over the face of dead matter that did not move.
Yeah, I think that's like one of the passages that people really come to, and I was speaking to a musher and like getting reactions from people about this book who actually do like sled dogs up in Alaska. And some people actually view this as not just this story of a dog or kind of a story about man returning to a state of like de-civilization. But it's kind of a spiritual journey and living life in the movement and getting away from like Jack London worked jobs where he worked in a cannery factory. And I see a lot of parallels between this idea of you're doing this like really mechanical grinding job and then you go to Alaska and you're in the wilderness and it's just all down to survival and nature and taking pride in what you can do with your own body. And this is so reflected here about just the ecstasy of being alive and moving on instinct.
And to bring this back to what you'd said earlier about people complaining about ascribing motivation to animals. I understand that caution we have to anthropomorphize animals, but I always find it equally baffling that people think, therefore, animals have no thought process or no interior life. That seems equally ridiculous to me that there's so many people, as you say, who want to treat animals as automatons acting entirely upon instinct without the ability to reason or reflect or have an emotional experience of their lives. That seems just ridiculous. Anyone who's sat and pet a dog for 5 minutes, you can't help but realize that these animals have a complex inner life.
Oh, definitely. And they do have an incredible joy when they run. That's kind of one of the magical things about being on a dog sled. I just do sprint races where you go as fast as the dogs can go for under 30 miles. I usually do like 4 or 5 miles. And at a start line, whether or not you're going to go running 20, 25 miles an hour, or if you're going to go trot 100 miles at 10 miles an hour, the dogs are insane. They are barking and jumping and screaming, and they are so excited to go. It's just, like, so joyful. It's kind of damaging to your hearing, perhaps, if you're at a big event. But it's such an amazing, joyful energy about it. And then you start going, and it gets quiet. You're out on the trail by yourself. It's just you and the dogs, and you just hear the runners of the sled, basically skis, and they're quiet, and you're moving through the woods like you're part of the pack. And it's kind of magical. And the dogs really are very alive when you're doing that. They're kind of, if you want to talk about an Aristotelian teleology, they are at their most dog-like at that time. Just seems like so such their being is to be running through the woods together as a group. And you can be part of that. So it is like a very beautiful and joyful thing. And I know a lot of people who participate in dog sledding, they don't want to sound silly, but they do find it a spiritual experience. Because you're just one with these creatures, and you're in nature in a way that you're normally not out in nature. And it's kind of amazing.
Now, one of the things that struck me reading this through the first time was, Buck's first experiences of being in a pack are not happy ones.
No.
He's thrust in with a group of dogs that have a strong hierarchy that it distrusts outsiders, and there's this one dog, Spitz, who keeps trying to pick a fight with Buck until eventually they have a fight to the death. Mm-hmm. And as the story goes on, London appeals to our sense of the natural world as a harsh world that is brutish and unfair, and yet in the end it's transcendent. You know, it's sort of like he gets sort of the bad stuff out of the way at first. And then Buck can eventually find his place in the world.
That's the thing about Spitz was like some of the most unbelievable stuff in the book to me. Like, yes, dogs will fight and dogs will have sometimes just develop a real dislike of other dogs and will fight to that point. But he's talking about that's almost like a primeval nature and science about how like wolf behavior was really in its infancy at this time. And people who observe wolves in the wild now, and as well as people who spend a lot of time with dogs, is that their structure is a lot more, their hierarchy is a lot more fluid. Dogs will take charge in different circumstances. And wolves have more flexible hierarchies and usually working in a family group. So this idea that it's like one dog that fights all the others and that it's in charge is kind of a very old-fashioned idea. But the one thing that I thought was really kind of hysterical about the whole section with Spitz is that there's this long workplace drama that leads up to that fight to the death. It's like Buck is like, oh, I'm not going to help correct the dog that's slacking off. I'm just going to encourage chaos so that the team is no longer functioning as a team. It's just going to be miserable for everyone, and then I'm going to take over. I don't know if dogs have that level of sophisticated workplace strategy or not. That seemed kind of pushing the bounds of my belief.
The other way that this book to me strikes me as a prototypical adventure story, as particularly in as you said, in the model of nature as an alternative to civilization. If civilized life is getting you down, go off into the woods. Devolve. You know, atavism as a lifestyle, is that the one thing that London I think finds unforgivable in his characters is incompetence.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sequence towards the middle of the book where Buck is sold into the hands of these three Americans. What are their names? Mercedes,
Hal, and Charles.
Right, and it's like two of them are a married couple, and the other is the brother of the woman, and it's sort of like they don't have any business actually being out in the wilderness. They're never quite explained what they're trying to do out there, other than kind of get in on the excitement of the gold rush in some way. And their crime is incompetence. They don't know how to work with dogs. And the dogs suffer because of this, and they even end up dying. And I thought this strikes me as something that will come up again and again in adventurous fiction, and even literary fiction of the 20th century, again by people like Hemingway and stuff. Is this idea that what makes someone worthy is not necessarily ethics or having a kind heart or having lofty aims. It's whether you know the efficient way to be in the world. Hemingway put all that emphasis on being an aficionado of things, and someone who knows is important. And I also recently have been reading the Travis McKee stories that are like American James Bond stories almost from the 60s. And they're you have these characters that are just super good at everything they do. And that's what you admire in them, is that ability to be good in the world.
Yeah. The whole, there's like passages about how they're preparing their sled that are just kind of funny because they're so incompetent. And there's so much emphasis on the economy. Like, the tent was rolled into an awkward bundle three times as large as it should have been. The dishes were packed away unwashed. And the way he treats the woman character there is pretty bad.
Yeah, this is not.
This is a really sexist story.
there's a couple of female dogs mentioned in the book, but they're never. Gender is not really a determining factor for dogs in this book the way that it is for people, I think.
Right. There's one dog early on that's like a little too soft and friendly and gets killed, and another one that eventually I think gets rabies and dies. And then, like, you have Mercedes, who is so kind and wants to be kind to the dogs. And then as soon as it affects her comfort, then it's like, oh, the hell with the dogs. I'm going to ride in the sled, no matter how much they're suffering. I'm going to get a perfect fight going between my brother and my husband. And it's actually kind of made me laugh. Some of them describes, like, how their fights and how they would start a fight over something really trivial or gossip, and she just wouldn't be quiet. Right. But, London, he kind of had a, he tried to sell himself as someone who actually went and did this, and with his these great feats of daring do, where he would float on a raft down the Yukon to the Bering Strait and do this, put the trail breaker over the Chilkoot Pass, and doing his backpacking and stuff. And the other stories are like, people couldn't stand him. That he was stuck in a cabin and was snowed in because he didn't get somewhere in time, and argued socialism and quarreled with his companions who just wanted to be rid of him, and spent a lot of time at taverns drinking and telling tall stories. And eventually he probably was ostracized because he stayed in a cabin and didn't leave firewood behind. So he was marked by incompetence. But he...
The little I know about him, he sounds like a perfectly difficult person, and the kind of person that would be wonderful to read a biography of, if you don't actually have to like know him or be friends with him. But before I was doing this podcast, my kid bought me this Viking portable library, Jack London, and I was reading through the introduction, and he just immediately struck me as the kind of guy who is just fun to read about because he makes up stories about himself.
Yeah, his life was just so incredibly fascinating, and he, even just like before high school, he had done so much.
Buck finally sort of finds his place in the North when he is rescued from this trio of bumbling Americans, literally minutes before they crack through the ice and drown. He's rescued by this guy Thornton, who is a prospector, and who is just a little bit too good for the world, I think. And Buck develops a strong love for Thornton, and his and Thornton's pack of dogs is not like the other pack of dogs. It is a much more, again, efficient, well-run place because they're bound together by their love for the man who, again, is, it's not that he's kind to them in a soft way. It's that he knows how to be a leader of dogs. He knows how to do everything that you need to do to be out there in the wild. In fact, I got a little bit irritated with Thornton as I read this book because he does some stupid stuff too, like when he bets the $1,000 on Buck being able to break a sled weighed down with 1,000 pounds free from being frozen and drag it so many yards or whatever. I felt like, first of all, it sounds very much like a like this was based upon some sort of thing that London heard about or something like some it seems unlikely to me that people would make this kind of a bet. But on top of it, if it were to happen, it seems like a kind of a jerk thing for Thornton to do.
It does. I was kind of surprised. It seemed like kind of a shift in his character for him to do that. It's like, did he have like gambling debts or something? Because why is he doing this to his dog? But weight pulling is actually like a sport that dogs do.
Oh, yeah?
And it was like big now it's mostly big in the pit bull community, but it started out like Malamutes, which were very, very large huskies. They don't go particularly fast because their job is to pull heavy things a long ways. So that actually is like a whole sport based on that. So having people do a wager on how much their dog could pull, I totally see that happening.
Yeah, you bring up breeds of dogs. It's good to note here that Buck, we're told, is a St. Bernard Scotch Shepherd, which is actually what we would call today a collie mix. But at one point in the story, London says that he looks more like his mother, the collie, than he does St. Bernard. I see a lot of illustrations that really kind of run with the whole St. Bernard thing and make Buck into a St. Bernard. But, you know, I think London thought of him more like an enormous collie.
Yeah, apparently there was a dog and an estate that he was friends with the owner, and so there was a place for where the dog came from was kind of modeled on an actual place, and Buck was modeled on an actual dog that he met and was quite enamored of. But whether or not this dog would be able to take down a moose by himself or or he'd like run wild the wolves, it's like, oh, his head was bigger than wolves, and I'm like, has Jack London seen a wolf skull? Wolves are enormous. They are terrifyingly enormous compared to dogs. You're like, that's a big-ass dog. You see a wolf, you're like, damn, that thing is huge. And the whole thing about, like, moose, I thought it was kind of interesting, that whole chase with the moose, because that's actually how wolves will, like, hunt, like, elk or something. Or moose in a pack. Just, like, constantly wearing it down, and probably how early man probably hunted. But moose, ironically, are one of, like, the biggest dangers in Alaska. If you run into, like, a moose with your dog team, you are in serious trouble. Like, mushers, if they go on long training runs or if they're doing trap lines and using their dogs for actual work, they'll carry a gun. And it's not for, like, wolves or bears. It's for moose. Because a moose can kill off your whole team very quickly. So the idea that one dog can just, like, take down a moose, I'm like, yeah, that's pushing my credulity quite a bit.
You bring up early man because there's one thing that happens to Buck through the course of his de-evolution is he starts to have visions of a hairy man, which is I suppose these visions of prehistoric humans that go along with the de-evolution of him back into a wolf-like state. That's a strange thing in a way that London. First of all, that London has this, again, atavistic experience that Buck goes through, be through the filter of visions, but not visions about other dogs. They're visions about earlier humans, you know, at the time of wolf domestication. And I don't know. I felt it was weird too. I also felt like it's not exactly close to what we know now about how long people and dogs have been together. I mean, the breeds are pretty recent in human history, right? Mm-hmm. They were only in the last 100 years, several hundred years, that the modern breeds existed.
Yeah, like the domestication timeline keeps getting pushed back, but when I was reading it, were they talking about the hominid like sleeping in a tree? So this is like really pushing it way back, and I thought that was a very strange, like, it kind of took me out of the story to be like, and you're having visions of cavemen. And he actually like wrote a short story about, you know, like pre-modern human characters. This was something I guess that he was really interested in, but it is kind of detract from the story, I think.
Well, it's so recent this is what, like 40 years after the Origins of Species. I mean, what is the timeline here? Origins of Species was like during the Civil War, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I guess it's kind of like Lovecraft is really fascinated by planets and thinking about Antarctica, and those are at the, you know, early points of exploration of Antarctica or learning new things about the solar system, so you have to put them into your works. And maybe he felt that way about early hominids, like, I gotta use this. Uh-oh.
But, yeah, the other thing, you know, to go extra textual of this, that I can't help but think, this was written, again, in 1903, the other really big influence I see in this book is, this is right about 10 years after Frederick Jackson Turner's The Significance of the Frontier to American History, which I brought up before in this podcast, and I'm sorry, I did go to grad school, and this essay gets pounded away as a seminal essay about the American experience that was going around at the time. That the theory was that in 1890, the census of 1890 declared that the frontier had been closed, or at least it had been broken up. There was no longer a clear frontier in America. And Frederick Jackson Turner writes an essay about 3 years later saying that the frontier has been central to the American self-conception. That's been the idea that the possibility of evacuating from where you are and going to a lawless land that has resources ripe for the taking, that has formed the American character, and that something's going radical is going to change. Now, a lot of people don't agree with Turner, and there's been a lot of criticism of being sort of, you know, reductive or too oversimplified, but it made a huge splash. And so you can see why the Yukon would be such an attractive place for people to at that time.
I think they struck gold in like 1896, and the rush was really underway by 1897. So definitely the frontier, they can say, was a little premature.
Right. Well, it was like, here's another place you could go. Yeah. You know, it isn't in the contiguous states. It isn't, you know, from coast to coast. It's like, here's a new frontier. And so I think that you see in this turn of the century, and certainly in the pre-war times, also the great heyday of like mountaineering and stuff, and all the big expositions to the Himalayas and stuff start around this time, and people are trying to find things in the poles because everyone's worried that we're running out of planet, and so now we got to find the new place. You mentioned before we started recording that you had talked to people who do sledding up in Alaska, and that this book is still resonant, especially amongst people from other countries coming to Alaska, You mentioned a German reader, I believe.
Oh, yes. Someone who operates tours in Alaska. He had a customer from Germany who actually brought along his copy of Call of the Wild. So it still, to a surprising degree, informs people's ideas of what Alaska and being out in the wilderness with dogs is like, for better or worse, because the way dogs are kept now is very different than you have in this book. You're not breaking them with clubs or one thing. But I think it's fascinating that it's had, that there's something about this journey to a frontier and this spiritual return to a state of nature and captures the imagination so much still.
In Germany, Westerns are huge. They're very interested in tales of the American West. The fact that that captures the imagination of people outside the country, that that's the way that they like to think of the American experience, is interesting to me. It also is a little bit problematic, though, because the Germans are particularly fascinated with Native Americans, and there definitely is this romance of the other and the noble savage that runs through that whole approach. This book reminded me in some ways of in the 18th and 19th century, there was a whole genre called abduction narratives, which were about Westerners, like European settlers, who had been captured by and raised by Native Americans. You know, probably a lot of these were made up over time. But one thing that all these narratives fed into was a European romance of what it would be like to live as, and here I again, big air quotes, a savage. And I feel like in some ways this book is a little bit like that at first. I mean, towards the end, it becomes less about a clash of cultures and more about the inevitability of biology.
Oh, yeah. And Lenin actually wrote a kind of a capture story, The Sea Wolf, with some nice, soft young men are taken by pirates and turned into pirates themselves. So it is definitely. And the way that he sounds to like these, how do you describe them? He exoticizes the French Canadians considerably and the Scotch half-breed. What is a Scotch half-breed? He manages to exoticize and like other white people, which I think was kind of fascinating.
Yeah.
And we know that he was actually quite a racist, though.
Right. Well, the French characters, what are they? Perrault and I forget his other guy's name. The first two people that Buck works for, they get to speak in the most ridiculous, transliterated French accent.
Yeah, it's really bad.
But that was kind of the practice in character, in writing characters up till, I don't know, like 1960. You read, if you read like old short stories, particularly old science fiction stories, everybody has like a character that's just their nationality is their character.
Yeah.
And that even like translated into the original Star Trek series. I think that was sort of the last time, that was the last hurrah for that sort of thing, when you had Scotty and Chekhov and Sulu, and they basically, my character is, I'm Scottish.
Yeah. But I guess to give him credit, like these like exotic French Canadians are actually like the first fair people he encounters in the Northland.
Yeah.
And they do right by Buck and the other dogs.
Well, they also don't care when Buck and Spitz get into a big fight.
Yeah, they're just like, he had two devils in him and the other only had one devil in him. I knew that Buck, he's going to kill him. It's just like,
what you going to do?
Dogs will be dogs, beat him with a club, maybe they'll stop fighting. You're just like, my God. And it just gets worse, and they get like become male delivery dogs, and and the Indians, right. Like the Native Americans,
right, okay,
do not come off well in this book.
No. At the very end of this of this story, Thornton and his companions, he's got a couple other guys with him, are killed by, what are they, Yahit?
Yeah.
Is the name. And I had to look this up. As far as I can tell, this is just something that London made up. I don't see any record of Yahit, except for when people are talking about this novel. And they basically kill Thornton and his companions for no particular reason, and Buck gets to kill them all because, you know, he's become the super wonder dog at this point.
Yeah, he talks about how he's learned the law of the club, but now that they don't have a weapon, then they're weaker than him, and he's finally killed the most clever and challenging prey of them all.
When London is talking about euphoric experiences or deep primal emotional response, I'm with him. I think that those are really beautiful segments. But whenever he tries to write an extended description of action, it all falls apart for me. There was a part where the couple of times that Buck saves Thornton's life, London tries to explain some action that involves snowfall, you know, avalanche, things breaking ice and stuff, and it just, none of it seems clear to me. And at the very end here, where Buck is fighting these Native Americans, there's ridiculous Looney Tunes stuff is happening. They talk about
they
take aim at each other, they shoot each other, and one stabs the other one because he's trying to reach Buck, and I'm like, no, I don't believe any of this.
Then he comes back to hunt this tribe yearly or whenever they come into his territory as he's ruling over the pack of wolves. Yeah. One thing I find that's really fascinating about this book is that, you know, the first couple of readings in my life, I'm this is a straightforward, back to nature, back to primal van, get rid of the soft trappings of civilization, almost kind of going towards a Nietzschean uber dog. But I think it's kind of conflicted on that point, because he's got also these very eloquent passages about talking about the dogs working together harmoniously and how well and how much he'll do for this one human that he loves. So they're actually, despite all this talk about rugged individualism and going back to nature, there is this constant callback to civilized values and kindness and respect for your teammates and your dogs and the good working relationship with others that kind of, I think, as it works in contrast with this back to nature stuff.
It's either the penultimate chapter or the one right before that is called For the Love of a Man. Mm-hmm. And that's all about the fact that Thornton is the only thing that's tenuously keeping Buck from going completely wild. Again, I feel like this romantic relationship, it felt strange to me. It felt a little bit again like Thornton was too good, and I was more interested at that point in Buck going off and killing Moose. But I do admire the fact that this book does end with Buck joining this pack of wolves and unapologetically just going feral. You know, it's and that you can see why that would cause a splash. You know, in this time, you can kind of get away with that kind of story, given that these are animals. If you tried to write a story about a human who went off and left society behind, you know, we think about models like Robinson Crusoe, and there it's the story is about how a civilized European is able to create civilization out of nothing in a wild situation. But what if instead Robinson Crusoe basically, you know, did a Lord of the Flies and went off and became some sort of a horrible cannibalistic monster. So there is something kind of shocking about that, and I admire London's sticking to his guns on this point. Although, as you mentioned, there's the companion story White Fang, which is basically the reverse of this book.
And that was about, like, years later, apparently. So I don't know what changed in his psyche, or if he just thought it would be an interesting intellectual challenge to go the opposite way. Or if it was, like, some values-based decision because he had these, like, very utopian socialist ideas about how society should be based on people each getting equitable access to opportunity, but working through service to make a better world. In between, you know, being really drunk and his kidneys failing. So, yeah, it feels like he has a lot of ideas in there, that a lot of them are intention. And, yeah, I guess that is actually, like, a real choice to be like, nope, he's just going to go feral, and that's the way it's going to be. He's no more men for him. So.
Well. I guess that's where we'll leave Buck. Do you have any thoughts on this? You've read this book several times now. Did you find yourself enjoying it more this time, or less, or
I think
in a different way?
I think in the third go around, like I mentioned earlier, like something about his socialist attitudes really struck me. Is that there's a lot of passages talking about how happy the dogs are to work. I think one of the phrases he says, the toil of the traces seemed the supreme expression of their being, and that all they lived for and the only thing in which they took delight. So, like, I'm impressed me has, they're doing this, like, very simple work. They're just pushing heavy loads, or, you know, pulling in the harness, but pulling in the harness is actually a pushing motion. They're happy in their work when they're treated well. And so it seems like he's expressing some solidarity with people who do manual labor and non-intellectual jobs, that there is an honor and decency to be had in doing work and doing work well and taking pride in it. And that kind of phrase about being happy doing their work and doing their work efficiently comes up over and over again. And that really struck me in the last reading. There was more humor in it than I appreciated the first couple of reads, about the arguments between Mercedes and Hal and Charles were funnier on a reread. So those are some of the things that jumped out at me.
You know, it's an incredibly short book, and it's interesting to me that it is so formative for so many people. A lot of people point to this book as being such a turning point in their young reading lives.
Mm-hmm.
I'm, as a much older reader and someone who's read a lot of stories of survival and stuff like this, it's not going to strike me that way. But I do see how, if you read this at exactly the right time in your life, this could be a game changer. And I imagine for me, the right time in my life would have been when I was 11.
Not when you were toilingly ceasing at shelving library books and wish you could return to, like, a state of nature and just, like, take joy in your muscle and running down deer and stuff.
Right. Are you pitching me our new podcast based on Tales of the Library?
No. I think not.
Thanks to my co-host, Laura Hayes. The reading this time was by Moises Kahoulian. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. You can write the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. You can join the discussion on Facebook or look for us on The Incomparable Membership Slack. Keep up with the reading, everyone, because everything will be on the final.